bad news about my vocation. I remember how the upper crust in my hometown pronounced it, caramel, which is correct, I guess, but to everybody else, it was caramel, which led to the misconception about the order of Carmelites. I imagined they served God by heating sugar to about 170 degrees Celsius, then adding milk and butter and vanilla essence while they listened to the radio. I thought I could do that. I could wear the white shirts and pants. I knew I couldn't be good, but I might be a good candy maker. So imagine my chagrin when I learned about the vows of poverty and toil enjoined by those particular friars. I also crossed off my list the marshmallowites and the apple pieites, two other orders I was thinking of joining.
The river is famous to the fish. The loud voice is famous to silence, which knew it would inherit the earth before anybody said so. The cat sleeping on the fence is famous to the birds watching him from the birdhouse. The tear is famous briefly to the cheek. The idea you carry close to your bosom is famous to your bosom. The boot is famous to the earth, more famous than the dress shoe, which is famous only to floors. The bent photograph is famous to the one who carries it, and not at all famous to the one who is pictured. I want to be famous to shuffling men who smile while crossing streets, sticky children in grocery lines, famous as the one who smiled back. I want to be famous in the way a pulley is famous, or a buttonhole, not because it did anything spectacular, but because it never forgot what it could do. Hokusai says, look carefully. He says, pay attention, notice. He says, keep looking, stay curious. He says, there is no end to seeing. He says, look forward to getting old. He says, keep changing. You just get more who you really are. He says, get stuck. Accept it. Repeat yourself as long as it's interesting. He says, keep doing what you love. He says, keep praying. He says, every one of us is a child. Every one of us is ancient. Every one of us has a body. He says, every one of us is frightened. He says, every one of us has to find a way to live with fear. He says, everything is alive. Shells, buildings, people, fish, mountains, trees, wood is alive, water is alive. Everything has its own life. Everything lives inside us. He says, live with the world inside you. He says it doesn't matter if you draw or write books. It doesn't matter if you saw wood or catch fish. It doesn't matter if you sit at home and stare at the ants on your veranda or the shadows of the trees and grasses in your garden. It matters that you care. It matters that you feel. It matters that you notice. It matters that life lives through you. Contentment is life living through you. Joy is life living through you. Satisfaction and strength are life living through you. Peace is life living through you. He says, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Look, feel, let life take you by the hand. Let life live through you.
Feel free to stay in your seats for this song. Wake now my senses and hear the earth call. Feel the deep power of being in all. Keep with the web of creation your vow, giving, receiving, as love shows us how. Wake now my reason, reach out to the new. Join with each pilgrim who quests for the true. Honor the beauty and wisdom of time. Suffer thy limit and praise the sublime. Now compassion, give heed to the cry. Voices of suffering fill the night sky. Take as your neighbor both stranger and friend, praying and striving their hardship to end. Wake now my conscience with justice my guide. Join with all people whose rights are denied. Take not for granted a privileged place. God's love embraces the whole human race. Wake now my vision of ministry clear. Brighten my pathway with radiance here. Mingle my calling with all who will share. Work toward a planet transformed by our care.
When was the last time you looked at a pie chart? For those of you who don't know or don't remember, there's one right there. This one shows the church's income by category, so thanks for your pledges. They really matter. And as you look at a pie chart, have you ever thought, I wonder who created the pie chart? Probably not. I know I never thought about it, but I have learned that the first known pie chart was published in 1801 in a book written by a Scottish man named William Playfair. The pie chart was then expanded upon and popularized by a person more familiar to most of us, Florence Nightingale, the mother of modern nursing. Many things had to happen for Florence Nightingale to popularize the pie chart. Mainly, she had to find her vocation, that thing she was called to do, her yes from the universe. Florence was born in 1820 into a wealthy English family. They were Unitarian by heritage, but her parents joined the Church of England for social reasons. She was born in the city she was named for, Florence, Italy. You have to feel for her sister, who was born in Parthenope and was subsequently named after that place. When she was 16, Florence had a mystical experience. She wasn't sure what to call it. In those days, upper-class young ladies didn't have mystical experiences. She later described it as hearing God's voice and knowing she was called to serve as a nurse. In those days, upper-class young ladies were not called to serve as nurses. And worried about what others would think, she didn't act on this calling. She didn't pursue her vocation. That led to years of internal torment. For 16 years, she felt this call to nursing, but did not act on it. She thought about becoming a nun, as that seemed to be the only way women could live a life of service in her day. But she realized she couldn't believe what she needed to believe to become Catholic. So she waited, and she suffered. That particular kind of suffering that happens when our aspirations and our lives don't match. She traveled. She spent time with other fancy people. She turned down a few marriage proposals, knowing she was not called to family life. And she felt tortured by her desire to serve and the unacceptability of serving to her family and to her class. And then 16 years after experiencing this call, she acted. Her vocation, her call to be a nurse, became more powerful than not meeting the expectations that were placed on her by her family and society. She traveled to Germany, enrolled in a 3-month nursing class, and became a nurse. It's amazing to think that 3 months was all it took back then. She served in the Crimean War, where she became famous for her compassion, dedication, and service. And she returned to England and founded the first secular nursing school in the world. She became very interested in public health and statistics, and she wanted to keep better statistics and communicate them better. So her desire to keep death statistics by month led her to adapt that pie chart, popularizing that way of presenting data. So living her vocation, answering that call, that yes from the universe for her, meant founding nursing as a profession and exploring new ways of gathering and communicating information. It's quite a set of accomplishments. I tell this story today as we have commissioned our religious education teachers to their particular service because it has a lot to say about vocation. Presbyterian minister and writer Frederick Buechner defines vocation as the place where your deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet, which I love. The place where your deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. I also love the phrase from the poem by Unitarian Universalist minister Teresa Soto that we heard earlier, the soft place where your talent can rest and your joy bubble up. Each of us gets a chance to answer what we will do with our life, to find a vocation, a call. I believe that each of us has a vocation, and I know that the ability to pursue a vocation is privilege. If we are struggling to survive, asking what we are called to do can be beside the point. If one is focused on survival, on bodily hunger, you don't always have time to ponder the world's deep hunger. And yet people whose existence is marked by struggle often find tremendous meaning and purpose. Most of the time, vocation is conflated with work. If you're lucky, your vocation is how you earn your living. For me, as clergy, so much of my professional formation was centered on my sense of call and vocation. What am I called to do? How does my gladness meet the world's hunger? And I am expected to have a call story to share when anyone asks for it. The more spiritual pyrotechnics involved, the better. And it's a story I'm happy to tell, but it's also a strange dynamic that can get very performative. I'm much more interested in why one continues to pursue a vocation when things get hard than why one starts on a particular path in the first place. Vocation can be our job, but it doesn't have to be. Being called is not about income, but about meaning. I learned a more expansive view of vocation as I prepared for marriage. As some of you know, my husband Brian was raised Catholic. He now is the president of the vestry at St. Luke's Episcopal Church downtown. But it was important to him, about 10 years ago, that our marriage count as a sacrament in the eyes of the Catholic Church. And as a lifelong Unitarian Universalist, this was a fascinating cultural immersion experience for me. I tried to be an anthropologist about it all. And what we found was sometimes really hard, and it's part of why Brian is no longer worshiping with a Catholic community, but there was also some tremendous value. So one afternoon, we sat in an office at the Archdiocese building, meeting with Deacon Jim, who guided us through the numerous hoops we had to jump through to get our marriage officially recognized by the church. There was a lot of paperwork. But first, he asked us why we wanted to get married. And there was only one right answer. Does anybody want to hazard a guess of what that is? I'm hearing children. Anything else? Because you love each other? So, for Deacon Jim, and I would guess a large segment of the Catholic Church, the reason to get married, the one right answer, is because that is the vocation you are called to. You get married because that is the life that God has called you to. Which is a powerful idea. We are called to our relationships, whether they are defined by marriage or not. Our love and our commitment can be one of the ways we meet the deep hunger of the world for connection and love and meaning. And if we are both lucky and dedicated, our families can be that place where our deep gladness meets the world's deep hunger. As Unitarian Universalists, this whole idea of call can be really tricky because we often start to think, well, who's doing the calling? And what does that mean? And that's part of it. And we all, I think, have our own answers to what that is. But for me, it's more the act of answering than the act of calling that matters. As one of my ministerial colleagues Richard Gilbert has preached, I've concluded how we name the source of our call should not be our primary concern. I'm not worried about its theological geography, but its power and authenticity. Whether we believe the call comes from God or from the heart, or if they are part and parcel of the same motion, I am convinced each of us is called. We have but to open our ears and hearts to hear and to heed. I'm content to let the mystery be about who or what or how the call comes. We can be called to the work that fills our days, whether that is work that gives us a paycheck or not. We can be called or not to relationships that could be marriage or not, parenthood or not. And we know that even when we feel a call to a particular sort of work or a particular sort of relationship, that isn't always how life unfolds. Some of us long for a particular work that does not materialize. Some of us long for a committed relationship and it doesn't happen for us, or it doesn't happen in the way we want it to. Some of us feel a call to be parents, and circumstances or biology thwart that call. This is real, too. Call and vocation are not a promise or a guarantee, but a nudge pointing us in the direction that might lead to the deep gladness. We don't always get to live our calls. Sometimes we are like Florence Nightingale in the first part of her story, tormented for 16 years with the particular disappointment of knowing what you are supposed to do and not doing it. There's grief there, an ambiguous grief that can be hard to move through or mourn. Your minister is here for that, as is this community. Recently, my idea of vocation and call has expanded further. Life sends us not only to work and to relationship, but to be our truest selves. Over the past 5 months, a group of People's People and folks from the Hearth and Grove Fellowship Pagan Community have gathered monthly for a class on transgender inclusion in congregations. It has been a powerful class that has shifted my thinking and feeling in powerful ways as I learn more both about gender and about welcome. The class is video lectures by two trans UU religious professionals followed by group discussion. And they are really good lectures. I commend them to you. And there will be information in the October newsletter about how to access them. Most of the lectures work well in an audio-only format, so I find myself listening as I'm driving or doing chores or otherwise getting things checked off the to-do list. But in a lecture on trans experience and spirituality, Reverend Michael Slack spoke about his experience of call. He says, "One of the things that comes up when folks are asking me to say more about my journey as a trans person is that there's this presumption that there are these specific things that you do to be a trans person. So we start going down these lists of things that I'm supposed to be doing as a trans person. And I say to them, I was called to be this person. Who I am right now is who I am called to be. I don't even know how or when this happened, and I can't explain that, but I know that it is true." Reverend Slack continues, "And so I move toward that call every day in all the ways that I can. And I think every person does that. Every trans person does that, moves towards that call in all the ways they can, recognizing that what that looks like and means is going to be different for everyone. But this mapping our pathway involves not how we understand ourselves, but also being surrounded by people who get us and who are going to help us be accountable to be the people we are called to be in the world. So call is about what we do, who we love, and also who we are. Our transgender siblings teach us that gender is something they are called to. They navigate gender and expectations as they figure out the person they were called to be. And we know that all of us, whether our internal sense of our gender matches what we were assigned when we were born or not, are navigating the complicated expectations, roles, and assumptions that form a thorny tangle around gender in our culture. So Reverend Slack's words have helped me to think about my own gender in terms of call. What particular sort of gendered human am I called to be? And how do I navigate all of the cultural expectations and my own internal voice as a woman in this world? These have been powerful questions for me to sit with in recent weeks, a powerful new awareness of a part of my life that I haven't given much thought to, I have to admit. So I invite you all into this reflection with me. How might you be called in terms of your gender? Have you heard a loud voice telling you who you are meant to be? Have you been quietly, maybe even subconsciously, listening to a whisper? Can you still yourself enough to listen to that voice within, that inner teacher? Can you say with confidence, as Reverend Slack does, I was called to be this person? If you can't, how might you need to change? And how might the world need to change for you to confidently be the person you are called to be? For you to confidently live into all of your vocations? American philosopher and psychologist William James states, "When engaged in an activity of one's true vocation, one hears an inner voice which says, "This is the real me." My hope on this, the first Sunday of religious education for children and youth, is that all of our teachers will have many opportunities to hear that inner voice say, "This is the real me." My hope is that our children will hear that voice say, "This is the real me," in their classes because of what they learn, but more because of the loving community that our teachers create in each classroom. I hope even more that our children and youth will gain the knowledge, wisdom, and confidence to lead lives where they say, "This is the real me," over and over and over again. That our youth participating in sexuality education will gain knowledge and discernment to choose the relationships and gender expression that they are called to. That our youth engaged with the coming of age curriculum will ask and answer big questions and come to understandings of what gives and will give their life meaning. That our children learning about the Unitarian Universalist tradition will be firmly rooted in our principles and values and equipped to find the places where their deep gladness meets the world's deep hunger. These are my hopes for our children, but they are also my hopes for each of us, all of us, across the lifespan. We know that learning isn't something that is over, ever. So may you fill your days with work that makes you glad and meets the needs of the world. May your relationships be life-giving. And may you know, as you live your life, this is the real me, and I was called to be this person. May it be so. May we make it so. And amen.